Servanthood is what Jesus exemplified for all of us. His leadership was servanthood. And he said the servant is not greater than his Lord. And so we need to readjust our self-image, perhaps, in recognizing that the position of leadership is a very awesome one, a very solemn one, and it is one which the Lord will give us help and strength to do, but we have to trust him for that. And I came across this wonderful little, it's not exactly a poem, by Ruth Harms Cockin. "You know, Lord, how I serve you with great emotional fervor in the limelight. You know how eagerly I speak for the women's club. You know how I effervesce when I promote a Bible fellowship group. You know my enthusiasm at a Bible study. But how would I react, I wonder, if you pointed to a basin of water and asked me to wash the calloused feet of an old woman, day after day, month after month, in a room where nobody saw and nobody knew?" Think about that. I was thinking as I was listening to these songs, almost all of which were unfamiliar to me, how easy it is to lie behind a hymn book or behind a overhead or whatever we have. And we said a good many times this morning, "I will trust in you." Let's make sure that we meant that and that we will do that no matter what God asks of us. In Ezekiel 17:24, we read, "I, the Lord, bring down the tall tree and make the low tree grow tall. I bring down the tall tree and make the low tree grow tall." And if that happens to be what God is working on in your life today, I trust that you will respond in faith and trust and glad obedience. Matthew 10:25 says, "It is enough for the servant that he be like his master." It is enough for the servant that he be like his master. And I think of one dear little lady who is one of the many who have greatly shaped my life. She was a short, rather dumpy little lady from Georgia who had come from a very, very wealthy family. And when she became a Christian, she was completely written out of the legacy that she would normally have had because her family were not Christians. And so she was more or less put out on the street. I don't know what in the world she did before she became a house mother at Wheaton College, but she was the dorm mother when I was a student there. And she was this short little dumpy lady from Georgia with a beautiful Georgia accent. And somehow or other she and I became good friends, even though there were many years of difference between us. She was also my Sunday school teacher, so we used to walk together on Sundays to church. And frequently I would go into her room and pour out my sorrows and tribulations to her. And every once in a while she would just tell me some little way in which God might be testing her. And she said to me one day in her very charming southern way, and she had a way of clasping her bosom, and she looked up at me and she said, "Oh, Betty." And I was called Betty in those days. Please don't call me that. I never did like it. She said, "Oh, Betty," clasping her bosom, "I came to Wheaton to be a spiritual counselor. But here I am carrying mops and toilet paper across the campus." Now, you know, that made a deep impression on me because I knew that she came from a home that had white columns in the front and servants in the back. And I don't suppose for a moment that she ever carried mops and toilet paper until she was a house mother at Wheaton College. But it made a very deep impression on me that this woman who came from a wealthy background was willing to carry mops and toilet paper back in the days when there probably was no such thing as a job description. She was just told that she was to be the house mother, and I'm sure that a good many things turned up as her responsibilities that she had not been warned about. Years later, my second husband, Addison Leach, and I visited her in the retirement home in Florida where she was living. And I reminded her of what she said to me that day. And once again, with that same gesture, she looked up at me and she said, "Oh, Betty, did I really say that?" And I said, "That is exactly what you said," and I never forgot it, and I told her why. And she looked up at me and she said, "Oh, Betty, just think of the mercy of God that He allowed me to carry mops and toilet paper for His glory." And of course, her influence on us women in that dormitory was infinitely greater because she was willing to be a servant. Are you willing to be a servant and to be asked to do ridiculous things that nobody ought to ask you to do? Are we available? Are we humble enough to follow one who laid down everything in order to show us what it means to love God? In John 13, verses 1 to 4, we read, it was just before the Passover feast, and Jesus knew that the time had come for Him to leave this world and go to His Father. Having loved His own who were in the world, He now showed them the full extent of His love. The evening meal was being served, and the devil had already prompted Judas Iscariot, son of Simon, to betray Jesus. Jesus knew that the Father had put all things under His power, and that He had come from God and was returning to God. Now get this, He was very aware that He had come from God and was returning to God. And verse 4 says, "So He got up from the meal, took off His outer clothing, and wrapped a towel around His waist." He took the form of a servant, even though He was about to return to His Father and to the glory of heaven. He knew His origin, and He knew His destiny. He knew where He came from, and He knew where He was going. But He also knew what was going to happen between that gesture in the upper room with His disciples and what His Father was going to require of Him very shortly. Now, He was going to be put into the hands of wicked men and nailed to a cross. But He moved with perfect serenity from point A to point B to point C, trusting in His Father and willing to take whatever His Father asked. And so He took upon Himself the form of a servant. And in verse 12 in that same chapter, it says, "When He had finished washing their feet, He put on His clothes, returned to His place. 'Do you understand what I have done for you?' He asked them. 'You call Me teacher and Lord, and rightly so, for that is what I am. Now that I, your Lord and Master, have washed your feet, you also should wash one another's feet. I have set you an example that you should do as I have done for you.'" And it may very well be that God is not asking you quite literally to wash somebody's feet, but there is no doubt in my mind that God is asking every one of us to be willing to take the position of a slave, the position of the lowest servant in the household, because in an Eastern household in those days, the lowest servant was the one who was assigned to washing feet. And washing feet was a normal everyday occurrence because people wore sandals and they walked on dusty roads. And so the gesture of courtesy to anyone who came into the house was to receive his foot washing. And so it was the lowest servant who was asked to do that. I don't know what God may be asking of you specifically, but very likely there's more than one of you here this morning who is being asked to do something which is not to your taste. Are you willing to do the thing that God is asking? General Robert E. Lee, that wonderful, amazing man who was in charge of the Southern forces during the war between the states. When the war was over and he had lost, he then became the president of Lee College. And there wasn't very much money. And Robert E. Lee had very distinguished guests who came to that home, a home where there would normally have been slaves and servants, but there wasn't the money for that in those days. And the story is that some of those guests did what was normally taken for granted. They would leave their shoes outside their door at night, assuming that a servant would take care of them. And guess who did the polishing of the shoes? It was the general himself, of course. Now, those of you who want to take notes, I'll try to help you with numbers 1, 2, and 3. Number 1, a radical shift in attitude. And I give to you Philippians 2, verses 5 to 9. A radical shift in attitude. Sorry. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, Philippians 2:5, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant. Being made in human likeness and being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Therefore, God exalted him to the highest place and gave him the name that is above every name, that at the name of Jesus every knee should bow in heaven and on earth and under the earth, and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord, to the glory of God the Father. Jesus has set for you and me the perfect example of taking the place of the lowest slave, of being willing to be made nothing, not to be recognized, not to be looked at, looked toward, not to take the place that we might choose to take, but the place which God in His mercy and His wisdom has assigned us. And if the Lord of the universe, the one who put the stars in place, the one who made everything that is, was willing to be made like a human being and taking the very nature of a servant, what is it that he's asking of you and me? The willingness to serve. And there's a sense, I think, in which Christians need to simply stand on their heads in order to see things clearly, because our world is so topsy-turvy. Everything's so upside down. In the last couple of decades, we've been hearing constantly about be good to yourself, do your own thing. If it feels good, do it. Don't let anybody tell you what to do, etc., etc. You know, all this secular rubbish that very easily sneaks into our thinking. And we begin to think, I am somebody and nobody's going to tell me what to do, and et cetera, et cetera. It's the disease of self-culture. And it's a deadly disease. Me first. The disease of rights and equality. A desire for recognition and honor and appreciation. A real honest look at ourselves in the mirror before God should bring us down a few pegs and to make us realize we ought to be asking the question, who do I think I am? I am only a servant. But what a glorious position to be a servant of the Lord of the universe and to do things just as he did, to be willing to do what he did. I hope that many of you are very familiar with Mary Wilder Tileston's little book called Daily Strength for Daily Needs. This book has been around for almost 100 years, and there's never a day that I don't find it appropriate to what happens to be going on in my life. And this is not the page for today's date, but it's one that I have gone over again and again. It's a quotation from Hannah Whitehall Smith, and she says, I have noticed that wherever there has been a faithful following of the Lord in a consecrated soul, several things have inevitably followed sooner or later. So let's just start with that statement. Wherever there has been a faithful following of the Lord in a consecrated soul, and I'm assuming that this morning I'm talking to a group of women who fit that category, you do earnestly and honestly want to follow the Lord and to be examples to whom others can look up. If you're a mother, you've got children who are looking to you for an example. If you are a wife, of course you know what your responsibilities are to your husband. If you're single, that doesn't disqualify you from being a spiritual mother. And I do believe that every single one of us is meant to be a spiritual mother. I'm so sad to realize how few older women are willing to obey Titus 2:3-5 that says the older women are to teach the younger women. Now you're looking at an old woman today, and I'm very grateful for the privilege of teaching younger women, but I want to say to you younger women, if you are 19 years old, you are an old woman to a 14-year-old. And when I was 9 years old, the older woman in my life was 15. She was Ruth Ritchie, and she lived next door, and we had just moved from Pennsylvania to New Jersey, and I was very shy and very lonely, and this dear Ruth, who lived next door, was just a sweet Christian girl who took this 9-year-old skinny kid under her wing. Now, Ruth, of course, never dreamed that she was an older woman who was teaching a younger woman anything. 50 years later, I was speaking in New Jersey, and somebody told me that Ruth Ritchie was there. And so I told this story about Ruth. Well, of course, she came to me afterwards, and just her jaw just dropped, you know. She said, I had no idea. I said, Ruth, I've been talking about you all over the country. So you were my older woman. So I don't know who's the youngest woman here today, but whoever you are, there are some younger people looking to you. So back to what Hannah Whitehall Smith says, wherever there has been a faithful following of the Lord and a consecrated soul, several things have inevitably followed sooner or later. Meekness and quietness of spirit become in time the characteristics of the daily life. Are you meek? I don't think it comes naturally to any of us, but I believe that perhaps an easier word for us to understand is teachability. I hope that I will never move out of the sphere of teachability. I want to be taught, and I am taught by people like Hannah Whitehall Smith and Mary Wilder Tileston, who put this book together. Meekness and quietness of spirit become in time the characteristics of the daily life. A submissive acceptance of the will of God as it comes in the hourly events of each day. And Lars and I were talking this morning about the fact that there are always little things, if not big ones, but virtually every day, there are little things that cut across our preferences. A submissive acceptance of the will of God. I know that Lars does not like it when the machinery or whatever it is up there doesn't work. And yet it seems to be par for the course, just about everywhere we go, that there's always some little glitch. A submissive acceptance of the will of God as it comes in the hourly events of each day. And you know, we only have this present moment right now. Not one of us knows that we're going to be alive in the next minute. So we have this present moment. Are you accepting the will of God as it comes in the hourly events? Pliability in the hands of God to do or to suffer all the good pleasure of his will. Sweetness under provocation. If you're in a position of authority in helping younger women, do you maintain sweetness under provocation? Calmness in the midst of turmoil and bustle, yieldingness to the wishes of others, and an insensibility to slights and affronts. And instead of saying, well, Elizabeth, if you knew what that woman said to me, or if you knew how she looked at me last Sunday in church, well, I don't know how she looked at you, and I don't know what she said, but here it says insensibility to slights. Leave it with Jesus. Did he ever experience anything like that? Do we think we have it tough? Absence of worry or anxiety, deliverance from care and fear, all these and many similar graces are invariably found to be the natural outward development of that inward life which is hid with Christ in God. I want my life to be hid with Christ in God. And God has given me tremendous privileges, but along with those privileges come awesome responsibilities. Don't capitulate to the disease of self-culture. Rights, equality, desire for recognition. I think of Moses and how when God called him there in the backside of the desert, Moses said, "You picked the wrong man. I can't do this. All Moses had ever done was take care of sheep and goats, which are bad enough, I guess, to take care of, but not nearly as bad as people." And he argued with God, told God he picked the wrong man, he couldn't possibly do it, he stuttered, he didn't want to go to the Pharaoh and say what God wanted him to say. And then, of course, there was Isaiah and Jeremiah, and both of them told God that he picked the wrong man. None of them were prepared to do what God wanted them to do. And then there was John the Baptist, and there was Peter, and we could go on and on. I think just about everyone mentioned in a high position in the Scriptures was quite convinced that this time God had picked the wrong person. And you, who are sitting here in front of me this morning, probably have some sneaking suspicions of a similar kind. I cannot even imagine supposing when I was hoping to be a missionary all my life that God was ever going to give me a position of responsibility such as he's given me, to speak to a group of women like you, to speak on the radio or to write a book. None of those things were in my wildest imaginings. So it takes a radical shift in attitude. That was point one. Number two, an assigned place. A servant is given an assigned place. And this morning, as we sat in the lobby of the hotel waiting to be picked up to come here, there were two little ladies there scrubbing the floor. And they were doing a beautiful job. I spoke to them, found out they were both from Mexico, so we had a little chat in Spanish. My Spanish is very sketchy now. It's been so many years since I've had reason to use it. But it was lovely to see the thoroughness with which they were doing their jobs. They had an assigned place. And they were willing to do what's probably considered the lowest job in the hotel. It was no question of competence in Jesus' case. He was God. And yet, he was willing to take the lowest place in an Eastern household. The Lord of the universe in the hands of men. And he speaks to you and me today and says, will you love me? Will you trust me? Will you be grateful for the place in which I have put you? And will you carry it out without arguing? I can still hear my mother saying to me, Betts, don't argue with me. Do what I say. And my daughter just wrote me the other day and told me about some difficulties that she was having with two of her children, a 14-year-old boy and a 12-year-old girl, who didn't want to do exactly what their mother wanted them to do. And my daughter homeschools her children. And so she has the awesome task of being in a position of authority and yet having to be a servant of God in raising these children for Him. Position of authority, of course, over the children. I hope that many of you are familiar with Amy Carmichael's little book, If. Everywhere I go, I tell people, quit reading Elizabeth Elliot and start reading Amy Carmichael. I couldn't tell you how many times God has taught me through her. And I want you to know that there are 14 of her 40 or more books. 14 are still in print, and they are listed in the back of my biography of Amy Carmichael, which is entitled A Chance to Die. But this little book, If, very thin, as you can see, but it is a blockbuster. And I just want to give you a couple of samples, which will give you some idea of what servanthood is about. She, of course, was an Irish missionary who went to India and established a remarkable work for little children who were in danger of being placed in Hindu temples for the purposes of prostitution. It was a terribly dangerous and horrible life that these children were committed to, and they were committed for life. And when she found out about this underground traffic, she began to pray that God would enable her to rescue some of these children. And God did enable her to do that, and at the height of her work, she had about 700 little boys and girls who had been rescued from those Hindu temples. But in the middle of one agonizing night, when she was going to have to get rid of one of the workers who was not being faithful to the Lord, she wrote this thin little book to herself. For example, it says, "If I belittle those whom I am called to serve, talk of their weak points, in contrast perhaps with what I think of as my strong points, if I adopt a superior attitude, forgetting who made thee to differ, and what hast thou that thou hast not received, then I know nothing of Calvary love. If I am perturbed by the reproach and misunderstanding that may follow action taken for the good of souls for whom I must give account, if I cannot commit the matter and go on in peace and in silence, remembering Gethsemane and the cross, then I know nothing of Calvary love." And the whole book goes on that way. And as you can see, there are blank spaces at the bottom of every page. And my Bible teacher, Mr. L.E. Maxwell at Prairie Bible Institute, used to say, the reason that Amy Carmichael leaves half the page empty is so that we can write in huge letters, guilty. Because every page socks it to me. I'll read this last one again. If I am perturbed by the reproach and misunderstanding that may follow action taken for the good of souls for whom I must give account, if I cannot commit the matter and go on in peace and silence, remembering Gethsemane and the cross, then I know nothing of Calvary love. God has given you and me an assigned place. And whatever that place may be, whether it's being a wife, a mother, a single woman, a leader in your church, a Sunday school teacher, a Bible teacher, whatever the assignment has been for you, I'm sure that if you've got any sense at all, you have probably argued with God, just as Moses and Jeremiah and Isaiah and all the rest of them did. Lord, you picked the wrong person. I'm not adequate for this. Some of you who were very ambitious to be Bible teachers, and God has given you that position, and probably it doesn't take very long before he smites you with the knowledge that you're really not nearly as good as you thought you were. And I certainly have argued with God about assignments that he's given me. But it's a cheerful acceptance. Cheerful acceptance of what God gives to us to do. A dear friend of mine told me a wonderful story of how God transformed her heart. She has a very difficult marriage. And she said, "My heart was transformed because of the love of God. My husband has not changed. But I am changed. I am glad that my difficult circumstances didn't change, because it was the only way that my motives for obedience could be purified." And I had to read that again and again, and I've kept it in my notebook, what she said that day. "I was glad that my difficult circumstances didn't change." And I dare say that I'm talking to some women here who have difficult marriages. I don't know a soul in this room, so I don't know anything about yours. But those of you who might be able to think of one or two tiny suggestions that you'd like to make to your husbands, and who of us wouldn't have one or two tiny suggestions? Some of you have really tough situations. But as my friend said, "My husband has not changed, but I've changed. I am glad that my difficult circumstances did not change, because it was the only way that my motives for obedience could be purified." Now, what do you suppose her motives for obedience might have been if they weren't purified? I think it might have been something like, "Well, Lord, I'll do this if you'll do that. I will do this for my husband if you'll change my husband." And I see some heads nodding. You understand that. And you know, we do bargain with God. Surely it's not fair for me to say I will do this unless God promises that he will do that. And God is not making that kind of a promise. He's saying, "Will you love me? Will you trust me? Will you praise me? I want you to be a servant, my servant. That's all there is to it." And as we serve our husbands, or we serve the people in the church, or we serve the pastor, or we serve our neighbors, we are doing the will of God. Do you do it cheerfully? Do you do it thankfully? And are you willing to do it, as Ruth Calkins says in her poem, "where nobody sees and nobody knows"? Would you be willing to do it day after day? And month after month. An assigned place. It is not a question of competence. It is a question of God's assignment. And so when God puts us in a place where we feel totally inadequate, that's when we have to cast ourselves completely upon him, isn't it? And say, "Lord, help me." And I find myself going around my house sometimes overwhelmed with work. The older I get, the more work there is, it seems. People are supposed to be retired, I guess, by my age. And there doesn't seem to be much likelihood that God is going to let me off the hook anytime very soon. And I find myself walking around the house, going from one thing to the next, knowing this has to be done before tonight. These letters have to be answered. This piece has to be written, etc., etc. And I fall back on Isaiah 50, verse 7, which says, "The Lord God will help me. Therefore shall I not be confounded. Therefore have I set my face like a flint, and I know that I shall not be ashamed." Now those are the prophetic words of Jesus from Isaiah 50. And so I find myself just saying, "Lord, help me. Lord, help me. Lord, help me. I can't do all this." And you know what? He helps me. Surprise, surprise. He helps me. That's what he said he would do. So now we're down to number 3, no personal agenda. Now the world is telling you, you gotta be good to yourself, you gotta do this and that and the other thing, you gotta take a break, you're exhausted. Now, don't listen to all those whisperings in your ear. Just put yourself at God's disposal. I am His and He is mine. I belong to Jesus Christ. I am not my own. I am bought with a price. That price was the precious blood of Jesus. I am His handmaiden. I am available. I was talking to a woman on the phone who was just so tired of being constantly demanded to do things and always having to be available. And I said, so what else is new? I thought you were a follower of Jesus Christ. He was mobbed all the time and people were always after him. He'd try to go off by himself and that people would get there before he did and meet him. He did spend time at night alone with his father, but there were a good many times when he tried to get away alone. But he had no personal agenda. He said, I do always those things that please the Father. I want to be able to say that. I do always those things that please the Father. So I have to say, Lord, help me. The Lord God will help me. I am a handmaiden. I am available. I am self-abandoned. Elizabeth Elliot does not belong to Elizabeth Elliot. I do belong to Lars Gren in a certain way, but I belong, of course, first and foremost and forever to Jesus Christ. I'm a bond slave, and isn't that a wonderful position to be given? I want to become like him in his death. Brother Lawrence, that dear little man who wanted to become holy, and he thought the best way to become holy would be to join a monastery. And so, to his utter dismay, when he got to the monastery, he discovered that he was given the job of scraping pots in the kitchen. And he didn't think that was very spiritual work. You know, we have very exalted ideas about what we think God would give us for an assignment, and the scrubbing of pots was certainly not what Brother Lawrence thought. But this is what he said. The King of Glory rewards his servants, not according to the dignity of the office, but according to the humility with which it is performed. Get that through your head. Now, the King of Glory rewards his servants, not according to the dignity of the office, but according to the humility with which it is performed. Servanthood means self-denial, self-abandonment. Not a very popular notion in today's world. It means cooperation with God. It means disposability. It means devotion. And I'll give you those four things again. This is another set of one, two, three, four. Servanthood means self-abandonment. That's number one. Number two, cooperation with God. Number three is disposability. I am totally disposable. Don't ever let me forget that, Lord. You can dispose of me any way you want to. Number four is devotion. A holy and humble willingness to call others to do as we have done. And if you have the responsibility of teaching younger women, teaching your children, don't forget that you set the example. You cannot tell them to do anything that you yourself are not willing to do. This is leadership, which springs from servanthood. And there is no true leadership without servanthood. Let's not aim at the leadership. Let's aim at being true servants of God. And out of true servanthood comes the kind of leadership which inspires. As St. Augustine said, by love is another heart kindled. And that was a motto in Amy Carmichael's bedroom. I had the great privilege back in the 1980s of going to India before I was going to write the biography of Amy Carmichael. I was allowed to sit at her writing table and I was in her bedroom surrounded by her books. And she had many different mottos on the wall and this was one of them. St. Augustine's words, by love is another kindled. It won't be by wisdom primarily. It won't be by the many gifts that we think we have to offer. It will be by love that another is kindled. And out of true servanthood comes that kind of leadership. We ask nothing of others that we have not asked of ourselves. And I see that constantly when I visit my daughter and her children. I only had one child. God saw to it that my daughter was only 10 months old when my husband was killed, and I didn't remarry till I was in my 40s. I always hoped that I'd have a big family. So it's a revelation to me to see my daughter coping with her 8 children. What a difference. So different from my own experience. But I see the most important thing in her leadership of those children is her setting the example. And your children are looking to you. Your children in the faith, your children in the flesh, your children perhaps in the job that God has given you if you're a working woman. So let me give you John 13, verses 16 and 17. I tell you the truth, no servant is greater than his master, nor is a messenger greater than the one who sent him. Now that you know these things, you will be blessed if you do them. The messenger is not greater than the one who sent him. And Jesus took a subordinate place when he became the servant of his Father here on earth. And he was the servant of all those who needed him. And he was willing to take that position. I want to close with some words that I have no idea who the author was, but I think it applies to all of us who are required to be leaders in one way or another. I am willing to receive what thou sendest, to lack what thou withholdest, to relinquish what thou takest, to suffer what thou inflictest, to do what thou commandest, and to be what thou requirest. And if God is asking you to take the hardest place, maybe it's a place of ignominy, a place that nobody's ever going to notice, thank him for it. Accept it. And remember that there is no leadership without servanthood. God bless you.